This podcast edition of Section D was first broadcast on Tuesday, the 20th of March, 2012. Section D, in association with Lexis. Hello and welcome to Section D, the weekly design hour here on Monocle 24. I'm Hugo MacDonald. This week we're talking architecture through photos, British post-war textiles, cinema restoration and Portuguese school building, all that and much, much more besides. So let's waste no time in cracking on. Coming up in the next hour, legendary minimalist architect John Pawson pops into Midori House to talk me through his new book.
I suppose it's giving other people a chance to see how I see rather than what I see.
We drop in on a new exhibition at the London Fashion Museum, celebrating the pioneering women in the British post-war textile industry.
Oh, I think Lucy and Day definitely saw herself as an artist. Her art happened to be textiles, and I think she went a long way into changing people's perceptions of textiles as a purely kind of decorative function.
And we debut a new regular segment on Section D, test driving a mystery piece of furniture with Monocle's photo director, Poppy Shibamoto.
Do you want to try sitting in the chair?
Does it make me look skinny?
It does, actually.
That's good.
You wear the chair very beautifully.
All that to come and plenty more over the next hour on Section D. Do stay tuned. And what better way to begin than with the master builder of some of the world's most exquisite buildings, British architect John Pawson. Pawson is far more than just an architect. Many hail him as a visionary, and a new book from Fiden gives extraordinary insight into his unique vision. It's called A Visual Inventory, and consists of a series of photographs Pawson has taken throughout his career. Whimsical, eclectic, beautiful in their simplicity. Each photograph is captioned by Pawson, who explains what caught his eye. He sat down with me in Studio 2 of Midori House to tell me more.
Fiden, who published it, Richard Schlagman, who owns Fiden, during the ash cloud that we had, I was stranded in Milan and he rescued me. And I spent the most amazing week at his house, which is a really beautiful Marcel Breuer house on Lake Maggiore. And so as a present, I gave him some of the pictures that I took there. I mean, I'd had a week, so I was able to take something like 3,000 photographs or something. I mean, that's all I did. My wife was going mad, not only because she thought we were overstaying our welcome, but because that's all I wanted to do was to photograph the house because it was so photogenic. And of course, out of 3,000, I chose 6, which of course, anyone should be able to get 6 good photographs. And of course, Richard said, oh, you should do a book for us. And the funny thing was, when I sent him my selection of photographs, which was a sort of cull from 250,000 that I've taken over the last 10 years, I was very proud of them. And of course, he said, what are these? because none of them were, pure, beautiful black lines on white paper or they weren't at all minimal. They were, they were the things that I used to work with, whether it's something that reminds me of something, which I can use in the work later or more realistically is the way I try and convey things to the people in the office. Because, as architecture is the sum of a huge number of people's work, and I'm just one of them. So it's really to get people on the same page as me, if possible.
And this is people not just that you work with, but people who experience your architecture, presumably, too.
Well, I never set out to do a book. I mean, it's just a concert, it was just happenstance, really. In a way, it's all that because people say, it's the same, the way I came to architecture was really by chance. I mean, I never really set out to be an architect. And, I've been very, very lucky with the clients that I've had and the projects that I've been offered. And it's strange in a way that, that they've come to me. I mean, the projects have come to me.
And I want to come back to that in a little bit because you as you say, have had a quite unconventional entry into the world of architecture. Yeah. But returning to your book, A Visual Infantry is what it's called. And it's a series of photographs all taken by you. Are you a sort of amateur photographer? You certainly don't look to be amateur from the quality of so many of these pictures.
Oh, I would never say I was a photographer. Not at all. I mean, it's an aid to me. It's a useful tool. I mean, I don't sketch very well. In fact, I would say downright poorly. And I mean, my sketches are well prized in the office because they're rare and very cartoon-like. So, you know, they get me to sign them because they're so amusing to them anyway. But, you know, of course, there's always the slight reluctance to dignify one's pictures by putting them in a book. I mean, they weren't intended ever to be professional photographs or stand up to it. They certainly aren't. And I wanted them to be put in the book uncropped. They're uncropped, they're unphotoshopped, they're as they are. I mean, the thing we've done, which in a way is curating, it's really a sort of curated show, really, because what we've done is to pair the photographs. And then I've written why I took them. And I suppose it's giving other people a chance to see how I see rather than what I see. Because they're everyday things taken on the move. I never go out to take photographs. I never go out and say, oh, well, today I'm going to make a photographic essay. They're always on the move. They're snatched shots. So in fact, they're not snapshots, they're snapshots.
I mean, what I love is how eclectic the different things are. There's a lot of things in nature, but also there's a lot of wear and tear in different buildings and materials over time. And I don't know if you agree, but over the last sort of 2 or 3 years, I've seen a series of books and articles written, attempts to translate architecture to people. And sometimes it's just a very academic sort of visual lexicon of terms that helps people spot an architrave in a classical building. Other times it's very much more sort of human, getting architects to explain what they were feeling when they were building a certain work or construction. And this is actually, I would say, sort of in that family, though a little more abstract. When I look through this and I read what you've written about the photos, and it helps me sort of interpret the way that you work.
Yes, I think all architects or all people that build are really have the same tools at their disposal, whether it be light, material, you know, texture, pattern, scale, proportion, mass, these sort of things. I mean, they all have those. It's just how you deal with them. And there's no magic, really. And I find it all always slightly strange. When I was at the Architectural Association, I vowed never to use, you know, I made a list of all the words I'd never use once I qualified. In fact, I never qualified, but I still don't use the word, you know, like tectonic or haptic or...
It's a relief.
Well, maybe it's because I can't... I still forget what they mean.
That was John Porson with me in Studio 2 of Midori House. And for an architect who masters space and light so well, I dedicate this song to him. This is the Scissor Sisters with Invisible Light. That was the Scissor Sisters with Invisible Light. You're listening to Section D. We'll be back shortly to talk British ladies and textiles.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
For the latest Monocle news, previews of upcoming films, glimpses of the new issue, and the inside scoop on all our retail ventures and new products, you need to do one simple thing. Subscribe to the free Monocle Bulletin. Sign up now at monocle.com.
Let's stay in touch.
The dark years of war in Britain were followed by a bright and productive period when creativity and industrial production blossomed. The country was at the forefront of international textile design in the 1950s and 1960s, and the movement was led by three women, Lucienne Day, Jacqueline Grogue and Marion Mahler, who came to spawn a paradigm shift in the textile industry. The new exhibition, Designing Women, at the Fashion and Textile Museum in London, shows how this female force took over the world, and we sent our reporter, Thea Erdl, to find out more.
On the cobbled streets of Bermondsey Village, a stone's throw away from the new expansive White Cube Gallery, lies the Fashion and Textile Museum. Although quite hidden on the South Bank in London, the contemporary centre, designed by Mexican architect Ricardo Legorreta, is by no means a humble structure. Founded by iconic British designer Sandra Rhodes, the centre showcases a programme of changing exhibitions exploring elements of fashion, textile and jewellery. Their newest exhibition, Designing Women, explores the significant impact of three female textile designers in the post-war era in Britain, Lucienne Day, Jacqueline Grogue and Marion Mahler. Curator Dennis Northdroft explains how these three led the way with their own unique signature.
The most famous designer we're showing is Lucienne Day, who with her husband Robin Day really set the standard for post-war British design, particularly with Calyx 1951, which featured at the Festival of Britain and was produced by Heels very successfully and actually really kick-started Lucienne's career as a textile designer. And both trained at the Royal College, very influential designer. You also have Marion Mahler and Jacqueline Grogue, also both very influential and versatile designers who actually trained in Austria and Czechoslovakia. Jacqueline Grogue was at the Wiener Werkstatt, and Marion Mahler was at the Art and Design School there. So they have a slightly different aesthetic, very versatile designers, and they came before World War II. You know, they obviously fled Europe. And came to Britain and they stayed there and then really made their mark in the 50s and 60s as well.
Northdroft first saw the exhibition in Colorado, US, and it's been a three-year process getting the expansive collection of 100 pieces on loan from Jill A. Wiltz and H. Kirk Brown to London. Although the three women came from different backgrounds, they shared a very positive outlook on things with their whimsical imagery and abstract, colourful shapes.
This particular aesthetic, I think, had a lot to do with the fact it was coming out of the post-war. I think there was an aspirational element that they wanted, well, food and flowers and trees. But also, I think it was a break from tradition because the traditional past didn't obviously work. I think there was a real sense that it was time to change. And I think it really picked up on things were happening all over the place. So you see Marion Mahler's work, and there's a lot of people like Miro and Calder are influencing what she's designing. So there's a real sense, and even you can see some of Andy Warhol's early illustrations are reflected in a lot of Lucienne Day's work, calligraphic scripts, ink over color.
One of the patterns that made the world take notice of female textile designers was the aforementioned Calyx by Lucienne Day, an organic visual masterpiece.
I think the importance of Calyx, it's abstracted, but it's still referencing an actual form, in this case, Calyx, a flower. So you get this kind of branching and kind of cup shapes of the flower, very abstracted, and then they're moved, and they're quite big. The scale of her textiles were quite big compared to what you were seeing in the 1930s, say, or the 40s. So all of a sudden, the scale got very big, and the colors were very strong, and combinations you didn't necessarily see together before that. So you get this sense of it continually kind of growing up the textile. But I think it was the scale and the color that people kind of responded to.
The three designers shared a blooming aesthetic, but it's interesting to see how different their approaches to textiles were.
Well, I think Jacqueline Grogan, we're lucky that we have a lot of her original sketches, so you can see her working process, which is very much fine art and collage and like mixed media to produce the actual textile. But her original kind of designs, a lot of them were produced for fashion. Even here, she produced a lot of fabrics that would become dresses, dress fabrics. So the scale tends to be quite different. You know, the repeats are different. And she works in a much closer, and her work is more dense than someone like Lucienne Day, who was really primarily in interior design. not interior design like you would have had coming out of kind of the 30s and 40s necessarily with chintz everywhere. So there was really, it was a new aesthetic, white paint and wooden furniture, probably influenced quite a bit by Scandinavia as well at the time.
Of the three, Lucien Day is without a doubt the most celebrated, mainly because of her quirky and playful use of humor in her designs.
I think the humor in Lucien Day, again, is a response to quite a dark time in history. And I think a lot of people were using a lighthearted approach. And I think Robin Day's furniture, similarly, you know, was quite seriously designed and had a high aesthetic, but none of it took itself seriously, and it was always accessible. I think that was another key, that people could afford it.
In the aftermath of the Second World War, textiles were still being associated with handicrafts. But these women, especially Lucien, were adamant about their influences and assertive that their output was art, and fine art at that.
Oh, I think Lucien Day definitely saw herself as an artist. Her art happened to be textiles, and I think she went a long way into changing people's perceptions of textiles and as a purely kind of decorative function. And she definitely saw herself as a fine artist, as indeed a lot of the designers now would perceive themselves. It just happens to be textiles. I worked for Zandros for a long time. You know, it's art, so it happens to be printed, but it's, you know, it's art.
Lucien Day, Jacqueline Grogue, and Marion Mahler were progressive pioneers and have without a doubt influenced a whole generation of young designers. So what does Northrecht feel about the future of textile design?
Oh, I think it's in a good place in terms of printed textiles. I think there's been a real kind of revolution. I think people weren't comfortable with print, either in their houses or in their clothing. I think we've kind of changed that perception, and now it's growing. I think it's growing tremendously. And it's really people like Mary Catranzi, Jonathan Saunders, I think, who really pushing the envelope, and I do think it's going more kind of digital manipulation. But the scope of what we can do, just possibilities are endless. I think printed textiles are in a very good place.
That was our very own Thea Erdl at the Fashion and Textile Museum in London. Sticking on home turf, I popped out to breakfast with the director of Design Miami Basel, Marianne Goebel. Over tea and toast, she took me through her first 6 months in the job and gave me a rundown of what to expect at the upcoming Basel show.
So Marianne, last time we spoke, it was the opening, or just after the opening night of Design Miami. How was the fair for you?
Well, it was my first fair in Miami, so I was full of anticipation. And it was a really great, successful week. Very energetic, lots of people. We not only had a really big increase in exhibitors, we had 40% more exhibitors than the year before, but also really, really strong increase in visitors from all over the world, the Americas, Europe, Asia.
And it was a commercial success too?
Yes, our galleries were very happy.
Good, good. And so now, sort of almost 6 months later, we're looking forward to Basel, which is how do you describe the difference between Basel and Miami?
I would say the two fairs are siblings, so they definitely share a good deal of DNA, but they are not twins. I mean, one is set in a Protestant city at the intersection of European countries. The other one is in a subtropical climate at the intersection of the Americas. So there's a strong difference in the cultural setting, and you also feel this, I think, in the in the character of the shows. But what unites them is the level, I think, the level of quality, and that both are serious pleasure. But for Basel, we will stage the fair in an industrial building. It's a former factory hall from the 1960s, beautiful volume with a mezzanine running along, and so we'll invest this amazing space to stage great gallery shows and a cultural programming consisting of design talks, design performances, WTS Design of the Future Award. So it will be quite a vibrant mix.
And is it the same crowds that come to Design Miami as come to Basel, or do people tend to only go to one of the two?
There's definitely a big part of the audience that we share with our Basel. So most of, I mean, most of our visitors also go to see Art Basel, but then we also have a core design audience that comes specifically for Design Miami.
And what about the difference between Miami and Basel in terms of, do the same people go to Miami in December and then they go to Basel, or do people tend to only go to either Miami or to Basel?
Now here again, you have a strong core who does both fairs, who visits both fairs, and then you have, in addition to that, the regional or national layers of the respective fair. So where in Basel we obviously attract a large amount of Swiss and German and French visitors who would not necessarily make it to Miami, and in Miami you attract many South Americans and Americans who would not necessarily come over to Basel.
And what are you looking forward to about this year's show in Basel?
We'll have, I think, a very interesting focus on lighting, experimental contemporary lighting, but also great historic light, with one gallery show by Gallery Creo actually covering the entire design history with about 200 historic lightings. We'll have a focus on French 60s and 70s historic design, solo shows on Maria Perguet at Gallery Demichtanand and on Roger Talon at Gallery Jules Entreprise. We will have a strong presence of small-scale objects, ceramics, porcelain, glass, silver. Galleries like Pierre-Marie Giraud from Brussels, or a first-time participant, Salon 94 from New York, with pieces by Betty Woodman. And we will see a strong influx of new contemporary work, with first-time participating galleries who commission work especially for the fair. So there will be a lot to discover on the contemporary side.
And talking about these contemporary commissions a little bit, do you feel like this is the way that the sort of industry is going in terms of design collecting? That for a long time the focus was very much on the past and sort of bringing old pieces to market. Now people, collectors, are getting a bit more open-minded about looking at new young work in a similar way and seeing the merits of collecting work from contemporary designers too.
Well, Design Miami is this platform for collectible design, and this really spans the entire 20th century, so rare pieces from the past, early prototypes, small series, or also site-specific commissions. There have always been, in the past, work that was developed for a specific purpose or a home or a public space. And the second pillar of Design Miami is the contemporary field, and here it's about, I should say, maybe more experimental or conceptual work that cannot be produced in a large series by its nature. By the technologies it applies, maybe also just by the character. This field is very young. This is something that has maybe emerged 10 years ago, and I think it had maybe, with everything that starts, it needs some time to find its place or to find its voice, and I think now it definitely has a strong voice. And in this field, things are happening that you cannot find in the industrial field. And yes, I think there is a need for more individual work. People are more and more interested in getting things that are maybe made just for them, or adapted for them, or adapted to the circumstances that they want to use them for. Mm-hmm. And this is exactly where our galleries come into the play.
That was me with Marianne Goebel, Director of Design Miami Basel in London. And from London, we head to Portugal, where a recent programme to modernise hundreds of Portuguese state schools has resulted in two particularly special projects in the town of Setúbal. One, a former dictatorship-era prototype, the other, a surprising set of buildings on the outskirts of a national park. Our reporter, Saima Tariq, visited the two secondary schools with architect Ricardo Carvalho, who, with associate Joana Villena, was charged with raising the standard for a new era.
This sports class at Sebastião de Gama School in Setúbal, a working-class town south of Lisbon, is taking place in a hall bathed in natural light. The small skylight windows above are barely visible, and yet the hall, which is also open to the public, is clearly lit, with panes of glass above showing the passers-by. Architects Ricardo Carvalho and Joana Villena not only built the school's new spacious facilities, which includes a two-story library complete with light wood-slatted facade and a rooftop football pitch, but they have also transformed the former dictatorship-era building into an open institution that is very much part of its surroundings.
When we first arrived to this school, we were quite fascinated, I think it's the right word, with the atmosphere of the old building from the 50s. Actually, since the 50s, the building was untouched and it was not changed at all, so we decided that the strategy to this project would be to keep the buildings as we found them. So we decided to create this new square, the heart of the school, as we call it, and the new building, the new library. We consider this project to be a city within the city. We call it the school as a city because it has the main square, central square, where everything happens, and the buildings are around it with different scales, different functions, different uses, and so on. That's the idea. In the Estado Novo, the new state or the fascist regime in Portugal that ran from the 20s to the 70s, they were associated with a certain gravity in terms of architecture, but also the atmosphere of the country was quite grey. And the building, of course, the architecture is always a reflection of the general atmosphere of one certain reality. So the new buildings that we designed, they were exactly the opposite. They were meant to reveal the new informality and lightness of the way that the contemporary pedagogical system tries to implement.
Inside the high-ceilinged classrooms, students are soaked in indirect but bright sunlight, thanks to a modern shed system, a nod to the town's working history. Leaving their lessons, students converge onto open-air corridors that echo Italian Renaissance-style gathering spaces.
One of the components of the school, one of the volumes, was somehow the backyard. This is quite funny because behind that you have one big avenue. So we decided to invert this logic, and instead of having a backyard, we created a very classical piece of architecture, a loggia, totally open to the city. But the city can also see the school. So this reinvented the way that both things connect with each other.
The project's impact led to another commission for the firm as part of Portugal's modernization program for its schools, which involved around 150 architect offices. Lima de Freitas, which will be fully completed in May, is a secondary school close to the Arabida National Park. Its original six pavilions have been transformed by Ricardo and Joana into a compact but complex structure.
So we thought that we should create a very dense system in order to not destroy the trees, the woods around, but also to create a memory of the old way the Portuguese architecture is built on that kind of environment, which is very white and dense among the green woods. The new system was much about creating a new public square for the students, but also to create a surprise when you discover the spaces, not only the classrooms, but also the external spaces like patios, mews, so you can have hidden places, open squares, mews, dead ends, trees, high windows, and really generous spaces inside that we compare to palaces.
During break time at Lima de Freitas, students dispersed to various areas created especially for them. The trademark long benches, the secret corners, both indoor and outdoor, overlooked by pine tree-covered hills, and corridor tubes of light that have replaced the older, dingier passageways. There is no graffiti or rubbish anywhere, and this, Ricardo says, is emblematic of the students' renewed sense of pride for their environment.
We experience here the importance of the public realm. In the public realm, in every dimension, every possible dimension, the dimension of the architecture, which is the physical dimension, but also in the sociological dimension. If you allow this community to have a very good public space, they will be better citizens. In the way, if you allow people to grew with certain qualities of the public interaction, they will be more aware in the future of the public life or the life in the collective atmosphere. That's mainly what we aim to create. when you have one entire country thinking about one problem, 150 offices, I believe, involved in this kind of program, and most of all, creating specific buildings and not prototypes, you will create an heritage of quality to the future that will be quite useful when someday the new generations will pick up on this precise departure point.
For Monocle in Setúbal, I'm Simon Tarek.
Time for a short break now, but do stay tuned. We're talking about a very special cinema after this.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
It started with a shop in London's Marylebone, and now Monocle also has stores in New York, Tokyo, Hong Kong, and a shop-in-shop in Osaka. And then there's the Monocle Cafe in Tokyo. Come in to find exclusive collaborations with brands we believe in, from Barena jackets to Porter luggage. Great for gifts, even better for personal treats. And if you're missing an issue from your Monocle archive, we can soon fix that. Visit monocle.com for store addresses and opening times. The Monocle Shop, carefully crafted design, proud of its provenance.
Welcome back to Section D. In a nondescript building in central London, formerly known as the Regent Street Polytechnic, sits a lecture theatre seeped in cinematic history. It was here that the Lumiere brothers presented their first ever moving picture show in 1896. Gillian de Bias spoke to Sarah Carthew, Director of Development at the University of Westminster, and Anna Bardos from Tim Ronald's Architects, about why heritage matters and how breathing new life into old buildings can help reignite the cinema experience.
Sarah, Londoners have been walking by the Regent Street Polytechnic for years without ever knowing that a cinema lurked there. Can you give us a little background to its heritage and why it's important?
It's a very interesting and complicated history, going back to 1838 when the building was first put together and the Polytechnic started there. It started as a business with shareholders and people interested in science and arts. And it has had many, many changes over the years. The facade has changed. We've got lots of images of the original building and how it's changed into and metamorphosed into the building that it is now. So what you see now is the 1912 facade, and so it's become quite imposing. It's part of that big Regent Street style. But behind that is all sorts of things. It's not just a cinema there, but obviously we're here to talk about the cinema. But there was things like the first swimming pool was there. The Europe's first photographic studio was on the ceiling of the theatre. And we know now that Charles Dickens had his photograph taken there, so we can prove that Charles Dickens went across the threshold. And lots of people went into the building. And so there are lots of people who know it because they've used it, and it's so it is today that people walk past it and suddenly they realise, well, that's actually, that's the Polytechnic, and things will start to drop into place. And so when we start talking about the cinema, people say, oh, yes, I know the building. I know what you're talking about. And isn't it amazing that there's so much there?
And no one really would have thought there's, you know, really the birthplace of where the first British cinema was.
No, but the cinema is there because the Lumiere brothers recognised the history of what was happening in that space beforehand. So things like magic lantern shows and Pepper's Ghost that came in through the 50s and 60s were all part of the history of scientific experimentation with illustration and with screenings. And there was a natural progression onto the moving image. And that's why the Lumieres chose that space to show the first moving images.
Now, when you're working and focusing on the regeneration and restoration of this cinema, and you brief an architect, what were you looking for? What was important to you to create a cinema experience when so many people are watching movies now on their iPads and phones?
The important thing is truth to the building. I come from a museum background, so I've been involved in the Great Court at the British Museum and lots of different projects. And so for me, it was really important that we restored and conserved all the historic aspects to that building and told the story of the building, but that actually people are really important too. And what we want to try and produce is a cinema that gives a completely different feel and experience from any other. You would, of course, and it's on Regent Street. I mean, what a gift for anywhere, anybody, any organisation. And what we want is to welcome people, to make people feel comfortable. So the things that we can do are to have really comfortable seats, to have a really good experience so that people will come again and again. And it's not too big, it's not too small, so you don't feel that like you're in a great big chain of cinemas. You don't feel that you're in a sort of musty, dusty type of room that perhaps you might feel a bit itchy. But this will be really high level, high comfort, so that it's something that you will remember. And it will be for everybody. So we're looking for people who will come who are interested in film, international film. Our students are going to be a very important element of this, so that we can show our student film too. And we'll be the only university in the whole world where students can premiere their films on Regent Street. The only one.
I'm going to touch on that a bit more later on. But first of all, I want to turn to Anna. Anna, you're charged with bringing this space back to life, architecturally, design-wise, really. Mm-hmm. What kind of research did you do to inspire yourself to create new life into the cinema experience?
We do a great amount of historical research, partly research into archives and old photos. Old newspaper clippings even were a great source of information, because photographs and books on the earliest stage of the cinema didn't exist. And also to get a feel for how important the building was at the time that it was built. There's also physical investigations that go on into the fabric of the building to see what remains. And that has been very exciting, because we have found in the loft space above the current ceiling the original 1848 cast iron girders, which were made by Joseph Bramah, a very famous engineer, and those have been discovered. As Sarah had mentioned, the building has undergone a great many changes over the time. It was originally built in 1848 as a lecture theatre for demonstrations of scientific experiments. It was changed into a slightly more debating chamber type of space in 1893. Further changes in 1912, the whole building in front of it was changed, and then in 1923 it was turned more into a permanent cinema arrangement. But now, also what's interesting for me is that it's a cinema space that really predates cinema, because it was the first place cinema was shown. So although that you can do historical research into the great booms of cinema building in the early 20th century and in the 20s, and actually very few of those cinemas remain, even those ones, whereas this is very unique as an older one and the very first place that cinema happened.
Interesting. You say it was the first place that cinema happened. Like, at that time, people were in awe when they saw the moving image on the screen.
Yeah.
Now, with 3D, they're not. How do you create that sense of
that sense of excitement? Yes, yes. No, you're right. And I think people were confused even sometimes at the moving image and what it, you know, was it real what they were seeing? I really think you can create that excitement. Partly, I mean, not that now people are very used to seeing moving images, but the design of the space, the way, the intimacy of it, the focus, the way you come in, just the sense of excitement, actually. I mean, I remember as a child going to cinema and finding it extremely exciting, and when the lights start dimming, you just can't contain yourself.
And it is the shared experience.
Yes, exactly. You're not sitting at home. And also, you're not seeing run-of-the-mill things at the cinema. It will be showing old footage, old techniques.
Archive film.
And also things that you can't see elsewhere, like Sarah mentioned, the student work. And that's actually just something I wanted to touch on, was also the space has this completely unique history of being a place of optical and sort of scientific and film innovation, which is continuing now into the future. So it's not the recreation of something historic, which is just showing historic things. The innovation is still happening, and that is where the excitement would come in for new audiences now.
Well, the British cinema is known for creativity, technical innovation. How is that going to play a part in this space?
Many of our alumni who've gone through the film school, which is currently based at Harrow, are people who've done extremely well in the film industry and won many awards. People like Asif Kapadi, I get the name right. Really important, that one. Who's done Senna. He's got a BAFTA. He's been up for all sorts of different awards. And he's just one of many. And we've got people like Michael Winterbottom, Tony Quizzoni. There are people who are really significant now within the film industry, behind the camera. And we are continuing to bring those people back into the university to help with our current students. And so there's a cycle, a natural cycle of people coming out of our university, doing really well, and then bringing those skills back into the next tranche of students that come through. And there are students now in their second and third years who are also winning awards. You know, Kodak Awards, they win on a regular basis. You know, they're doing really well.
The film industry is notoriously hard to break into.
Correct.
For film students. And I wonder if you can give us a sense of why a space like this, bricks and mortar, will be important for young students to get a showcase, and how it might change the nature of the British film industry in nurturing talent.
Well, firstly, because the work that they're showing is of an excellence that people will want to see. So there's an excellence that people are always drawn to. Then there's the opportunity for people like Paul Tribitz, who's owner of Ruby Films, to come in and work with students and to make more of the skills, and that they can actually use the cinema. It's a proper working cinema to be able to understand how films are shown, understand how audience respond to them, and use that to put into the next film that they're going to make.
I suppose what I want to touch on is that in a day and age when real estate is so valuable, what is the importance of having a real space for people to showcase? When on the internet they can show films, people can download, is the investment in a space important for young filmmakers?
It's interesting you should ask that question, because one of the things I keep saying to myself is this one of the right things to do? But there are so much investment in films at the moment that film is never going to go away, both as a commercial entity and as a creative entity and as a place where people go and think and enjoy and test things. And that's exactly what our cinema will do. So it'll be a mixture of commercial, it'll be a mixture of testing, it'll be a mixture of enjoyment, all sorts of different things. And it'll just be a sort of cornucopia of all sorts of different ideas coming together in one place.
And Anna, your firm's had experience with the Hackney Empire.
Yes,
again,
exactly.
Another similar project. From that experience, what kind of a sense do you have that a cinema can indeed reconnect a community?
Oh, greatly, actually. The Hackney Empire was very key to the community at the time, continually. And one of the things very many people said was, please don't spoil it when we started work on it, because they loved it how it was. And that's one of the challenges, actually, with historical buildings, is to respect the history, but also to keep what relevance it has to the current people who use it, and to encourage that as well, and to make it accessible in the widest sense, to make it appealing and to tap into what people already love about the place.
That was Gillian Tobias in Studio 2 of Midori House with Anna Bardos and Sarah Carthew. We head back to the sanctity of Midori House, where it's time for the debut of a new regular feature here on Section D. In the spirit of talking about design in human terms, each week we'll be testing a piece of furniture with Monocle's photo director, Poppy Shibamoto. She'll talk us through the design as she sees and uses it.
I do like this chair. The hint is it's made in Japan, and it perfectly fits to my legs, which were short. And you know, like in Japan, we traditionally we don't sit on a chair, we sit on the floor, just like we are sitting now. So it's not our culture to sort of sit on a chair and table to eat dinner. That came kind of in, like, you know, last 100 years. So it's nice, like, this is made in Japan, but also, like, it kind of shows that by having the shorter legs. So it's really comfortable for us.
So even though you're not sitting on the floor, you don't feel too far away.
Exactly.
From it?
Exactly. In that way, it feels really comfortable. And you know what I really like is this armrest, which is a bit like a... You know how I really like, even in any apartment or anything, you see like staircase and you see a really nice carved banister. And then that's that. It's just you want to touch it. You want to go down the stairs and you want to touch it. That's how I feel with the armrest.
And the armrest is wood and it's oak. And it's been, I think, soaped rather than polished. So it feels very natural, doesn't it?
Yeah, but it's still not hard or anything. And also, yeah, it does feel soft and a little bit carved.
And what do you think when you look at the joins here, because it's made up of several different pieces, but it seems to fit together very perfectly.
But you think it's the same type of wood, right? All of them are the same type of wood, and it has just it just shows different grain and different colour, which is nice, isn't it?
It is, it's very nice. And what I like about it is, well, I know a little bit about it. It comes from a very old wood furniture manufacturer near Hiroshima. And they have turned themselves from being wooden craftsmen into machine-made pieces. But even though the pieces are made by machine, they still feel...
It does feel
as if they're made by hand, don't they?
Yeah, and also I'm sure, like, design drawing stage, they must have done this by hand, you know. Like, it's not a computer-drawn piece of design.
No, exactly. It's been made by people, definitely. And it's upholstered.
I think it's a grey felt.
Grey felt, which also feels very natural and makes you want to touch it.
Exactly.
Do you want to try sitting in the chair? So you're laughing, which makes me think that you like it.
You know what it is? It is armchair, so obviously I should, you know, like, it's not a dining chair, but I always have this problem of my feet doesn't touch the floor.
You're a bit smaller than most people, though.
Yeah, I'm 5 foot, and my legs are shorter than average 5 foot people.
But you're lucky in this chair, as we said before. It's quite a low chair, so your feet do touch the floor.
Yeah, and then I think I can put more weight around my waist, and I'll still fit in.
It's generous girth, which is unusual for a Japanese chair, because Japanese people tend to be...
Does it make me look skinny?
It does, actually.
That's good.
You wear the chair very beautifully. So, marks out of 10?
11.
Oh, I think you're biased, though, to your nation.
I think so. Yeah, Japanese wood. Nice.
And do you know who designs the chair?
No, I don't. What's the name?
It's made by Maruni.
Yeah, made by Maruni.
But it's designed by Naoto Fukasawa, who, no surprise, is one of my favourite, or actually one of our favourite designers in the world. Naoto Fukasawa is the creative director of Maruni, and many people say he was the man who rescued it from becoming old-fashioned and has made it an international company. And I'm now sitting in it, and it feels very comfortable. No, it doesn't at all. I'm not sure it's the kind of chair that you would necessarily be able to eat at the table. And you probably wouldn't want it in a meeting room. But we have it in our reception area here at Midori House. Yeah. And the number of people who come in and talk about...
Exactly. I have done so many portfolio meetings with the photographers on these chairs.
And do they like it too?
I think so. They tend to want to stay longer.
That was Poppy Shibamoto testing out Naoto Fukasawa's Hiroshima chair by Next Maruni. And that's all we have time for in this week's episode of Section D. Next week we're doing a San Francisco special, so be sure to wear some flowers in your hair. This week's show was produced by Gillian DeBias and edited by Holly Fisher. I'm Hugo MacDonald. Thank you for listening.